this nice sunny spring day. Okay, let's try and get all of you out of here as soon as possible so you can enjoy it. We'll be good to you today. 11-3085 Nipponkoa versus Atlas. Mr. Maloof, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. So my name is David Maloof. I represent the appellant, Nipponkoa. My argument can be summarized with three phrases, and I'll explain each one of them. The three phrases which summarize my argument are, one, $295,496, final answer. The second phrase, Exhibit Guard is worse than broccoli. And the third phrase, Kirby is a joint. You know where that comes from. And the third phrase, Kirby, is a joint credit card. Now, let me explain. Phrase one, I'm assuming familiarity with the facts. I'm not going to go through them, of course. Phrase one, $295,496, final answer. Toshiba had a 20-year relationship with Atlas carrying its goods. Comtrans was Atlas's sales agent. Debbie Kemp of Toshiba sat down and negotiated a flat rate to move these 23 machines to the exhibition hall in Chicago.
But Mr. Maloff, I mean, I assume where you're going with this is that there was a very substantial payment made for this shipment. But I note that you did not make any particular declaration of the value of the shipment on the form. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the
form is merely a receipt, and actually, it's not where I'm going that it's a substantial payment. Where I'm going is that it's a flat rate payment that the contract entered into by Toshiba orally with Comtrans as Atlas's agent was a flat rate agreement with no limitation of liability. And the form that you're referring to, I assume, is the bill of lading.
Bill of lading, yeah.
Is merely a receipt here. The arrangement made for 20 years was to do this orally, and these are receipts to pick up the cargo. They're being handed to a warehouse worker.
As a factual matter, you argued that Atlas set their rates, as you just said, with TAMS orally. Did TAMS deal directly with Atlas, or did it always go through Comtrans? Because from the record, it seems that TAMS oral agreement was with Comtrans, not Atlas.
They always went through Comtrans. Comtrans is one of Atlas's largest sales agents. So they essentially are the salesmen for these transactions. They book the deal for Atlas.
Was there anything in this agreement between TAMS and Comtrans, or the initial arrangement, indicating that Comtrans had discretion downstream, if you will, to enter into different arrangements in which limitation of liability might play a role?
No, absolutely not. And that's really my third point, which has to do with that this Kirby is a joint credit card situation. So let me answer your question by jumping to that. Kirby, Werner, Great Northern, they're all cases where the shipper needed an intermediary to negotiate a rate and get a carrier. And, for example, Kirby, which is a typical multimodal contract, the shipper needed the carrier to get railroads and truckers. And that's typical for multimodal carriage. So it's like a joint credit card. In other words, I have a credit card with my wife. It's a joint credit card. If she makes purchases, I can't complain later, or vice versa with your husband. But this was not a joint credit card situation. TAMS made their own deal for the price of these goods, and there was no discussion of a limitation of liability, and it was a final answer. It was a final deal. There are no other carriers here except Atlas.
Critical to your position is the notion that both Comtrans and ACS are, at a minimum, agents, I take it, of Atlas. In other words, they sort of collapse all into one. They're all Atlas somehow or another.
Exactly, exactly. ACS is owned by the same person who owns Comtrans. They work out of the same office building. They are just an affiliate of Comtrans. They are both, therefore, essentially agents of Atlas, and there's no downstream carriers here. So it's not like Great Northern.
But wait a minute. Sorry. Forgive me.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're arguing that this wasn't a downstream carrier situation. But isn't that exactly how TAM structured the arrangement? In other words, TAMS hires Comtrans, knowing that Comtrans is then going to engage a carrier. TAMS might not have realized that Comtram would hire ACS and that ACS would deal directly with the carrier, but TAM certainly knew that Comtrans wasn't transporting the exhibits, right?
No, Your Honor, with all due respect, Comtrans
is... never say that. Never. All of you, never say with all due respect, because what follows is always terrible.
I promise I won't make it terrible. But Comtrans always deals with Atlas. This is a 20-year relationship. Comtrans is the sales arm of Atlas. So they didn't go to Comtrans and say, find me a carrier and get me a rate and figure out a limitation of liability. They came to Comtrans and said, you're moving hundreds of goods for us a year. You've been doing it for 20 years. We're paying you $2 to $3 million, and you're always using Atlas. They came and said, we are Atlas. How should we move these goods? Not, we are Comtrans. We'll find somebody for you. If that were the case, I wouldn't be here today. Comtrans was retained, was spoken to strictly as Atlas's agent.
So does Comtrans ever deal with a carrier other than Atlas?
I don't know that. Their brochure is in the record, and it's got big. We are Atlas's largest agent. I can say I have no information that they ever booked anybody but Atlas for Toshiba in those 20 years. So they didn't come to them, to be very clear, as some kind of third party intermediary, and we'll find you a carrier. They came and said, "We're Atlas's agent. What's the price today?"
So I want to come back just for one second to this bill of lading, because I had the impression, which is never something that I like, reading the briefs in this case, that they were, to use the phrase, ships passing in the night. So reading your brief, there is a sense that, first of all, this bill of lading is just a receipt in this instance. It's not a carriage contract in itself. And secondly, that because this was an exhibit shipment, that there were, in a sense, a whole different set of rules, different tariffs, and the only backup would be this exhibit guard thing, which is just kind of a comprehensive, during the entire duration of the show, policy. When I read the other brief, you could cite any amount of money you want. You can have $10 million, you can have 55 cents, you can have, whatever, and it's all available. And I don't know what to make of this, frankly. I'm not sure whether this means that we have to delve into these tariffs even more and figure out what the contracts say, or whether there are disputed issues of fact, or what. So any help you can give me on that,
okay,
I would appreciate.
Well, on the face, it sounds like issues of fact, because we did have conflicting testimony, which the district judge overlooked. But the court can probably decide for itself, and I would say this, ignore what we're saying and just read the tariff. The tariff is what the shipper has to be bound by. The tariff at item 190, at item 3035, is what they rely upon for this all-encompassing, you can declare any limit you want. But item 3035 does nothing more. And by the way, these tariffs are incomprehensible. I mean, in the
and Tempest, you're wanting us to read them?
I'm wanting you to tell Atlas to write it so someone can understand it. I've been doing this 30 years, and I still pick it up this morning and still can't read it.
So item 3035 is on page A67, right?
Correct. Let me check.
So we have this item, and I want you to tell me exactly what language in this. Actually, we only have one page of it. Maybe that doesn't matter. So I just want to know, where do you find in the tariff the idea that you can't just declare a value and that these exhibit shipments default over to exhibit guard if you're not going to use the 60 cents a pound rate?
Well, Your Honor, I take that from item 190 in the tariff,
right,
which is the section which specifically applies to a released value.
All right.
And
that's page A66.
I can't find it here, but I believe that 3035 sends you to 190. But in any event, 190 is the section on released value. And that's in, let's see, A66, I believe.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to read it.
It has, do you want to read it or should I continue?
If you can just tell me what your argument hinges on, that
sure.
would be great.
It says, okay, so this is, so you want to declare a released value. You come to this and you try to understand it. And these are not lawyers, by the way. And they read item A190, except as noted herein. And this is the beginning of how you declare a value. And it says, when a shipment is released to a value exceeding the maximum liability, as stated on the application page of the indicated transportation rate section on the bill of lading.
But you're looking at exception 2, when an exhibit shipment is released to a value exceeding.
Right. Well, my first point is that sentence is incomprehensible.
Well,
I have no idea what they mean about the application page of the indicate. But let's move to, then it says.
Well, doesn't it mean that Atlas's liability was limited to 60 cents per pound unless the shipper declared a higher value? Isn't that what it means?
I don't see a reference to 60 cents there, Your Honor.
No, but...
But what the point is that...
That's what you're... I mean, you have to go to another area to find the 60 cents.
Right, you got to go back to item 3035, and then that leads you to 190.
Right.
But this has exception 2, which is the exception dealing with exhibit shipments. And this is my point. Exception 2 says, if you've got an exhibit shipment, forget everything else. Here's your section. And it says, when an exhibit shipment is released to a value exceeding the maximum liability, again, as stated on the application
page. You go to exhibit guard protection.
It says, the carrier shall, not may, not this is one of many options, the carrier shall issue a certificate for exhibit guard.
And then you're in your rebuttal time, but I just want to wrap this up by, you had in your brief emphasis that pretty much everybody in this case said, exhibit guard protection isn't a limitation of liability.
That's right. Their own claims person said that.
Yeah. Okay.
And how could it be? Because it's requiring you to take out 3 weeks of insurance just to move your goods. That's like saying, I'll give you a limit of liability, but take out flood insurance. It's worse than broccoli, forcing you to eat
so
broccoli.
So you can't buy from exhibit guard on a cafeteria plan, I take it. You can't just buy the coverage for the shipment to the place of the exhibit, exclude the middle and buy the coverage for the back end.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
And if they had done that, again, we wouldn't be here today.
Okay.
And there were no claims in the year 2008 under exhibit guard, and they did away with it. And that says to me it wasn't a real option. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Sauvé?
A moment to gather my stuff.
Absolutely. We need time to clear our brains.
Pen there.
Whatever you need, get. You know, get. Don't.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Never.
A drink of water.
Piece of toast. Cup of coffee. Anything that helps.
May it please the Court. My name is David Sauvé. I'm here on behalf of Atlas Van Lines. to argue and request that this court affirm the ruling of the district court for the very simple reason that it was correct in all respects.
Okay, can I just start you off because some sharp words, you know, have been exchanged in the briefs about documents showing that exhibit shippers other than TAMS used the service of Atlas declared values in excess.
Correct.
Of the 60 cents per pound.
Correct.
Where in the record will we find these documents? Because Nipponkoa says at pages 7 to 8 of the reply brief that these documents are not in the record in the district court and not in the record on appeal. Is that true?
The documents themselves are, it was a stack of documents this thick, and they were not presented to the trial court, to the district court, because it didn't seem to be an issue. It came up during oral argument when Mr. Maloof said, your only option is exhibit guard, and I pointed out to the court that during discovery we had provided plaintiff, at plaintiff's request, a list of shippers who in fact had declared values in excess of 60 cents a pound without buying exhibit guard. And the testimony of Mr. Coulter, the vice president of Atlas, was that's what they do. That's how they interpret their tariff. That's what they allow.
But the documents themselves were a stack this thick, so those documents themselves are not in the record. We get documents thicker than this courtroom. So
and that, but to answer your question, the documents themselves were not in the record. That's how the issue came up.
And wow, well,
that's a real problem.
Mr. Coulter's testimony is in the record with respect to the fact that Atlas does allow exhibit shippers to declare any value they want without having to buy exhibit guard.
But his testimony can only tell us something about maybe Atlas's state of mind. It doesn't tell us about anything that any particular shipper did. That would be hearsay.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It does tell you how Atlas interprets its own tariff and how it applies its tariff, and it is contrary to the position taken by Nipponkoa that the only option is exhibit guard.
It certainly sounds like a disputed fact issue to me that would need further fleshing out.
By the way, who is the shipper? Your brief seems to switch back and forth between TAMS and ACS. You know, sort of depending on which entity favors your argument at the time.
TAMS?
Who is the shipper, and why should we treat them as the shipper?
TAMS was the owner of the goods. As far as Atlas was concerned, they had a contract with ACS, under which, by the way, the bill of lading was declared to be a delivery receipt. It is not a delivery receipt if the ACS contract doesn't apply. It is the contract. That's what the district court decided.
But, you know, my problem with that theory is tracing back to the ultimate shipper, which is what I'm going to call TAMS right now, the knowledge that certain limitations of liability may occur downstream. Most of the cases that you cite and these various cases with the Himalaya clauses and all that kind of thing all involve the initial shipper essentially saying, I get it. I understand that there are going to be limitations of liability down the way, and that will dictate against whom I might bring a lawsuit if one becomes necessary, and so on and so forth. I understand all of that, but I don't see that here, and I would appreciate your starting by explaining to me as clearly as you possibly can what evidence in the record documents the relationship between Atlas on the one hand and Comtrans, and between Atlas and on the other hand ACS. Record evidence.
The testimony and the record evidence is that Comtrans was an Atlas agent. It goes out and solicits customers. The customers are the customers of the agent. TAMS is a Comtrans customer. TAMS has a subsidiary broker or affiliate, whatever you want to call it, called
ACS. Well,
it
makes a difference to me what you do call it, because if Comtrans is effectively a subsidiary of Atlas, that's one
no.
thing.
No, I'm
if
sorry,
Comtrans
Your Honor.
If Comtrans is an independent company that is Atlas's most important agent, it certainly tells me that when TAMS goes to Comtrans, TAMS is going, in effect, to Atlas. That's what the law of principal and agent means.
Mm-hmm. Comtrans is not owned by Atlas. Comtrans is, in fact, an independent company.
And what about the relationship between Comtrans and ACS, since they seem to have the same address, phone number?
They are have, I believe, the same owners.
So they are. They effectively are the same thing. So, but when no one tells TAMS that when it contracts with Comtrans, Comtrans may choose to limit the liability in some undisclosed way, even that it's going to limit the liability. I mean, in this post-deregulation era, there's got to be some choice. Pay less for less service, pay more for more service. But where's the choice here?
The choice is exactly that. If TAMS had wanted to declare additional valuation on this shipment, all they had to do was tell Comtrans, we want $1 million worth of valuation on this.
But apparently
it would have been charged
an
additional $4.50 per $1,000 of valuation, and away you go.
Apparently that was never done, and the only
no,
thing
it wasn't
they
done.
Would... No, I mean like never in 20 years.
Correct.
And you have no documentary evidence in the record that anybody else did this differently. And you also are in a situation where there's this ambiguity about where Exhibit Guard comes into the whole picture.
You cannot read the tariff in isolation. Item 3 of the tariff, if you start with the tariff in item 3, it sets out what the released value is. It sets out the language that will be in the bill of lading, and that language is in the bill of lading.
When you're using the phrase the tariff, what are you talking
Atlas
about?
Atlas Tariff 500.
Say it again.
Atlas Tariff 500, it's the tariff that's in the record.
And where is it in this? Is it in this appendix?
It is in the appendix, Your Honor.
Page what?
It starts
at page, right at the beginning, page 4, or actually maybe page 5. But
So the bottom line is ACS and Comtrans were Atlas agents. And
no, ma'am. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but ACS was not an Atlas agent.
They were not an Atlas
no,
agent.
No, ma'am, they were not.
But
just
they're the
Comtrans,
same thing as Comtrans.
But they had the same address. I mean,
that's correct. But Atlas did business with ACS on the basis of a contract that set out the relationship between Atlas and ACS. ACS was the customer. Atlas billed ACS for the services that it provided and was paid by ACS. ACS then turned around and billed its customers and Comtrans customers for whatever services Comtrans provided for each shipment.
You know, on page 4 of your brief, you say that TAMS has done business with ACS during the years it has been working with Comtrans. When I looked at your record site, it actually says that ACS works with Comtrans and sometimes sends bills to TAMS. And that seems like a stretch of support for the assertion that TAMS has done business with ACS. Is there any evidence in the record that TAMS thought of ACS as anything other than the invoicer or billing agent for Comtrans?
The testimony in the record from Ms. Kemp, the TAMS manager, was that she did business with Comtrans and she did business with ACS. Whoever she got bills from, that's who she paid. I don't know what she thought TAMS was doing or what Comtrans was doing. She testified, and I believe this is also in the record, that she depended on Comtrans to provide whatever services were necessary to get her shipments from, in this case, California to Chicago. And if that meant, including if Atlas didn't have any equipment available, putting it on some other carrier to get it there. All she cared about was getting it there. Atlas billed for its services, and this is goes back to Mr. Malouf's point about $295,000. Atlas billed ACS for its services. It didn't bill $295,000. It billed, based on the tariff, rate as defined in the contract with ACS. Atlas doesn't control what Comtrans and ACS bill for their services to their customer. So this, as far as Atlas was concerned, this wasn't a flat rate case.
You know, on page 3 of your brief, you cited the language of item 190.
Yes, ma'am.
Which refers to the application page of the indicated transportation rate section
right.
on the bill of lading.
Right.
What does that mean?
That means
what
item
is the application page, and where in the record can we see it?
The application page is item 3035. The first page
that's
of item 30.
That's the first page of 3035.
Yes, Your Honor.
Uh-huh.
And that says, rates apply on shipments released to a value not exceeding 60 cents per pound per article. When shipment is released to a value exceeding 60 cents per pound per article, or shipper declares a value of, on the entire shipment, the rates in item 3035 apply, plus the additional charge in item 190. That's... So, I mean, there's no requirement in 3035 that you buy Exhibit Guard. Exhibit Guard happened to be a product that was offered for a while because most of the damage to exhibit shipments happens not while it's on the truck, but while it's being dragged in and out of exhibit halls by draymen and lumpers.
But, you know, this does seem ambiguous to me because I see the cross-reference to item 190, but then when you go to item 190, it may be that you could read the opening paragraph, which begins with the words except as noted herein, and then there are two exceptions. But suppose you put that to one side. Maybe you could read that as independent, that there was going to be a 450 per thousand. But since it says except as noted herein, it seems logical to look at the two exceptions. And exception two is for an exhibit shipment and gets you over to that exhibit guard protection. So it just seems clear as mud to me.
But you get exhibit guard if you ask for exhibit guard. You
no.
can declare a value without asking for exhibit
That's
guard.
Not
that
what
was
it
the testimony
says,
of Mr. Coulter.
That's not what it says.
That's but Mr. Coulter
you
testifies.
You wrote these tariffs. I didn't. And it doesn't say that. It says except as noted here, and then there are two exceptions. Nobody seems to think exception one applies. It's exception two.
All I can tell you is that the testimony from Mr. Coulter is that Atlas allows exhibit shippers to declare value on shipments without buying exhibit
cards. But why do we have to believe Mr. Coulter in the face of language which could reasonably be interpreted a different way?
It's the Atlas tariff. It's how Atlas applies its tariff. Who else is going to determine how Atlas applies its own tariff?
Atlas wrote the tariff.
That's
a
correct.
Reasonable person could interpret the tariff differently.
But a reasonable person...
I mean, why would you ever have litigation? You just would have a rule that the moving company always wins. Easy. That's very cheap, I guess. But
a reasonable person would also know by reading the tariff or reading the bill of lading, as the court indicated, that your liability is limited unless you declare a higher value. And that's there were two parts to the court's ruling. One is that the ACS contract applied, and the ACS contract has a specific limitation of liability in it unless additional... valuation is requested and additional fee is paid.
But TAMS never saw the ACS contract.
No.
And so it had no idea that it was buying a pig and a poke. I mean, I don't know why they're doing business with Atlas, actually, under these circumstances.
In all of the cases that have been cited, the owner of the goods, the first person in line, never sees the contract at the end of the line.
But they do sign a contract that says, I realize that further down the line there will be limitations.
Not necessarily in all cases, Your Honor.
If you most of the cases you cited had contracts like that.
And a lot of them did not.
Well,
the one in Great Northern didn't, for instance. The one in Werner didn't. In fact, the Werner court said it doesn't matter what is done up the line. The only thing that matters is the agreement between the last person in line and the person right in front of them.
You know, in the reply brief, Nippon Koa says at page 19 that there's no evidence in the record that ACS had the proper federal license or legal authority from the Department of Transportation to act as a broker. You haven't had a chance to respond to that, but you do now.
In the record, no, there isn't a copy of their broker's license in the record, no. they do have a broker's license, that it was provided to Nippon Koa.
But it's not in the record.
No, it's not on the record because it didn't say it.
So we just have to say, well, you know, Mr. Sovai said they do, and so.
But, Your Honor, you don't have to be a broker to be an intermediary. Anybody can be an intermediary. And that's the law, and that's what the courts have said. It's the fact that you're using an intermediary that triggers the
Yeah, but on page 4 of your brief, you say Atlas picked up this load tendered to it by ACS at the Comtrans warehouse.
Correct.
What support is there in the record for the idea that ACS tendered the load? It seems much more likely that Comtrans tendered the load and did so on behalf of TAMS.
Testimony of Mr. Coulter that...
Here we go with Mr. Coulter.
I mean, testimony is testimony, Your Honor, and it's in the record. I don't know what else to tell you.
But summary judgment isn't a time where we resolve testimonial disputes. That's the problem. People have gotten so carried away with summary judgment.
I can't disagree with that, Your Honor. But all I can tell you is that the court looked at the ACS contract, looked at the law, and decided that the law with respect to intermediaries is that an intermediary can bind the owner of the goods up the line with a limitation of liability. There's no requirement of a Himalaya clause. There's no requirement of a contract of any kind between the first shipper and the first person in line.
Would you consider Comtrans, would you consider ACS to be an affiliate of Comtrans?
In a general sense, yes, I probably would. They have a common owner, as I understand it. They're a separate corporation, but they have a common owner.
So it's both an affiliate and an intermediate?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean an intermediary?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's both an affiliate and an intermediary. I have to think about that. Okay, is there, you know...
Well, I had a whole list of things I wanted to talk about, obviously, but I was more than happy to...
The most important one, and I'm going to give Mr. Maloof an extra 3 minutes.
Well, the most important, Your Honor, I think, is just to keep in mind that... that the district court looked at the documents and looked at the law and correctly interpreted the law with respect to intermediaries and downstream limitations. It looked at the ACS contract and the relationship and said, yes, this is a contract. Yes, it does all the things that Hughes says you're supposed to do to limit liability. It applies. Even if it didn't, you still have the bill of lading, which contains right on the face your liability is limited unless you declare an additional valuation, and Toshiba had given its freight to Comtrans for storage to keep until it was picked up. The bill of lading was signed by the person in possession of the goods when Atlas picked it up without any declaration of valuation. Therefore, valuation is the liability is limited. That was the court's ruling in a nutshell, and there's nothing that the plaintiff has provided that should cause this court to disturb that ruling. With that, Your Honor,
Thanks, sir.
I seem to have overstayed my welcome, so I will.
No. No one overstays their welcome here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, so how many?
Thank you, Judge Robner, and I have to say, you're a lot more polite here than sometimes in New York. Thank you.
This is the Midwest. Welcome to the center of the world.
I think Judge Wood has really hit up my argument on the head in saying that, and this is important not just for this case, but this Kirby is being interpreted for other cases. The modern decisions are very simple. And in Kirby, the Supreme Court made perfect sense where they said, if you enter into a contract that allows the intermediary to enter into downstream contracts, that's a joint credit card. You're done. And that's fine. But what happened here, And by the way, Mr. Salvi said that the other cases there wasn't a writing, but in fact in Werner there was a writing. He was wrong. In Werner, the invoice said, I will enter into downstream contracts for you. And the shipper accepted that. In Kirby, there was what's called a Himalaya clause, which automatically extends the limits downstream. So all the modern cases have a writing by the shipper essentially saying, you're my agent, good luck, do your best, and then you can't complain later. That's my first point. I'm sorry.
No.
Okay.
My mouth is hanging open because it just is.
My second point is, and Mr. Savvy said, well, how would they get a higher limit? He said they'd pay $4.50 per $1,000. He himself just said that exhibit guard is the way to get a higher limit because that's the exhibit guard price that he was quoting. And by the way, the exhibit guard price in the tariff turned out to be the wrong price. That's also in the record.
I thought the $4.50 appears elsewhere in the tariff schedule, too, though. It happens in the thing we have in the record to reflect the exhibit guard price, but isn't it also mentioned in other sections?
I can't tell you that off the top of my head, Your Honor. I recall it. I know it's in the exhibit guard price, which is page, which is item 190.
Well, right, but see, the first part of item 190, that's what I'm thinking of, the opening paragraph, before we get to the exceptions, the last sentence is, the charge to the shipper for the cost of this coverage is $4.50 per $1,000, subject to a minimum of 45. And then we get down to exception 2, which is where exhibit guard gets mentioned, and then we have that same price repeated. So whether they reflect the same thing or a different thing is essentially what I'm asking.
I think they reflect the same thing, but my point is from the point of view of a shipper being given a fair opportunity, they admitted in the course of the case that was the wrong price. It was now
$9. Right, yeah.
So what kind of an offer is that in writing when you give the wrong price? That's not a fair deal for the shipper to read that and make a decision. My other point, you've asked about the interrelationship between Atlas and Comtrans, and if you look at the record at A59 and A60, we've put in Comtrans' brochure, and it says Comtrans has the Atlas logo on their brochure, official van line carrier, Comtrans in the top, Atlas on the bottom, on A59. And then on A60, it says Comtrans/Atlas van lines is pleased to have been selected by this convention. It says, as the largest agent for Atlas van lines. So you can see, I don't know. We didn't take discovery on whether they have some other little purse company they also give goods to. But you can see this. It may be they're exclusive. I just don't know. But clearly, they're one and the same in the industry. And they're advertising themselves that way. My last point.
So is Exhibit Guard a red herring?
I don't think you have to rule on Exhibit Guard to overturn the district court.
Is it because it's an insurance product that's unrelated to the issues here? Why? Yeah.
Well, because the offer wasn't made independently. This was a flat rate contract by TAMS, and these Atlas agents don't really affect that. But if you go to Exhibit Guard, what I would say is, it is insurance, and insurance is being tossed out here in every time the shipper wants to do something. If you even look at the bill of lading on page A51, where they give the shipper the blank to declare a value, it says the declared value for the property of blank. Okay, so if this was household goods, somebody might fill that in. It probably wouldn't be done in this context because Debbie Kemp's made her deal for the $295,000. But let's play along with it. If this amount exceeds the maximum released rate in the tariff, carrier shall obtain insurance in this amount. Even in the bill of lading, not all, everywhere, Atlas was attempting to not pay claims and to make the shipper take out outside insurance. And they have two cases, actually three cases in our brief, the GE case, and there's the federal, get the exact name. But there's three cases which have said even transit insurance, federal insurance case, even transit insurance is not adequate. And why is that? Because this is not the carrier agreeing to more liability. This is sending you to a third party who might have exclusions in the insurance policy, who might have insolvency issues. So I don't know that you have to go that far, but if you decide to, I think insurance is not enough. And clearly, exhibition insurance, which is a three-week policy just to move your goods for one day, is a kind of a bundling of products. So I would conclude by saying those documents were not in the record. They were not verified at any deposition. When the other attorney attacked me for not citing to them, the only reference to them was an attorney argument. At oral argument. He said they were introduced in a hearing. No, it was oral argument. And the documents weren't even there. It was just the attorney referring to them. So I did not appreciate the attack. But I do appreciate all of your courtesies. And I'll answer any other questions.
Okay. I think you can go home. We're going to take the case under advisement, of course, since our heads are whirling. And we're going to go on to the second.